Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Arizona Daily Star. I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we're bringing you the Star for today, Tuesday, the 4th of March, 2025. I thought before we went to the Star this morning, we'd have a look at today's weather. This is what the National Weather Service has to say for its synopsis. It says the area will be in between weather systems today and Wednesday, with temperatures warming up. The next weather system will move across the area Thursday and Friday, bringing breezy to windy southwest winds, small areas of elevated fire weather conditions, cooler temperatures, and better precipitation chances. The upcoming weekend looks dry with warmer temperatures. And what they say further is that there's really no change in the progressive weather pattern for the next week. It results, however, in roller coaster rides in temperatures, they say, as a pair of weather systems impact the area. One this Thursday and Friday, as I just mentioned, and there's another one coming our way next Tuesday. So I guess we need to be prepared for the roller coaster ride in temperatures. There you have it. That's the weather summary for today. And now we will go to the Arizona Daily Star. Thanks so much to the Star for donating this subscription to Sun Sounds of Arizona. So I am going to be going to our front page stories. This is the set of titles we have this morning. Tucson logs driest August to March record. Lawmakers move to roll back cage-free hens rule. Trump fumes as Zelensky says war's end is, quote, far away, unquote. The University of Arizona announces investment in key areas of research. And then finally, for many of you who have interest in this story about the Pope, I can give you an update. The Pope suffers another setback. He's been put on ventilation. So let's go ahead and start with that first front page story. Tucson logs driest August to March on record. This is the driest early August to early March on record for Tucson in official weather statistics going back to 1895. Since August 9th, only 1.09 inches of rain has fallen in Tucson at the international airport where it's measured. The previous record low rainfall for the same seven-month period was 1.91 inches, and that was in 1973-74. The drought, combined with a period of unusually warm to extreme hot weather since last summer, has caused a lot of stress on desert plants. Several experts said prickly pear cacti in particular have been seen collapsing. Even hardy creosote bushes have been showing brown foliage in the desert west of Tucson, said Mark Dimmitt. And Mr. Dimmitt is a longtime expert on native plant growth and a former botanist and natural history researcher for the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum. In the current dry period, if the current dry period continues and the upcoming summer monsoon season is drier than normal, it's possible a lot of desert plants will die, said Dimmitt, and also Ben Wilder, a researcher and former director of the Desert Research Laboratory on Tuamuck Hill. Don't write off the desert just yet for serious damage. The plants need a bad winter and a bad summer, Dimmitt said on Monday. You see the ends of cholla's drooping? That's not a problem, he says. You see the prickly pear lying down? That's not a problem, said Dimmitt, who today works as a full-time private horticulturist. They'll come back with summer rains. If the summer rain fails, you'll see more death. Tucson has experienced a number of weather extremes and records, or near records, since mid-summer 2024, National Weather Service statistics show. February 2025 had the city's second warmest temperature for that month. October and December 2024 were both the warmest and the driest Octobers and Decembers on record, while December tied with five other Decembers as the driest on record. What's known as the meteorological winter from December through February was, in 2024-2025, both the second warmest and driest on record. September 2024 and all of meteorological summer from June through August 2024 all experienced record-setting heat, although they were exceptionally dry, records show. Long-time water conservation activist Val Little said she's noticed the drought impacts on prickly pear cacti in her front and backyards near the University of Arizona. Many are collapsing, she said. I'm having to hand water stuff that I've never watered before, said Val Little, founder of the Water Conservation Alliance of Southern Arizona. My mesquite tree, my choya, several prickly pear, they just look stressed. They are wilted and having color changes. They don't look good, she said. There's no start of any wildflowers growing or other spring shoots, she said. Grasses also aren't coming up. Usually, as soon as we get late winter rains, we start to see green. We don't even have weeds this year, she said. So there you have it, and this is Tucson's driest August to March on record so far. Let's go to our next front page story. Lawmakers move to roll back cage-free hens rule. Well, state lawmakers are moving to undo a pending rule meant to provide more humane treatment of laying hens, claiming that stopping it will hold down egg prices. The measure, already approved by a Senate panel, would strip the Arizona Department of Agriculture and its authority to enact the rule requiring farmers to move to cage-free operations. The rule was supposed to be in effect now, but got delayed until 2026 amid concerns of effects on farmers in what has now become a multi-year outbreak of the avian flu, that is to say, the bird flu. The legislation from Senator Shauna Bolick, that's B-O-L-I-C-K, Shauna Bolick, a Republican from Phoenix, to overturn the rule before it takes effect would allow hens to be kept all their lives in cages as small as 67 square inches of usable floor space. The department adopted the rule amid threats that animal rights groups would put the issue directly to voters and in a way that would force farmers to more quickly change their practices or face criminal penalties. Hickman's Egg Ranch, the state's largest producer, gave its blessing to the state rule as a compromise. Now, however, the industry is lobbying to scrap the rule. If that happens, the same groups whose initiative threat spurred the rule could be back, this time with something less to the industry's liking and which lawmakers could not override. I can't say exactly what we would do regarding a ballot measure, said Chris Holbein, public policy director for Farm Animal Protection at Humane World for Animals, the group formerly known as the Humane Society of the United States. But, he said, the organization is committed to getting a regulation enacted. We will continue to explore all of our options on it, Holbein said. In 2020, what was then the National Humane Society floated the idea of putting a measure on the ballot to require all eggs sold in Arizona to come from cage-free hens. The idea so concerned the Maine farms, including Glenn Hickman, president of the company that bears his family name, that he agreed to the deal, have the legislature adopt the standard, but with a delayed effective date. That measure faltered. But the Department of Agriculture picked up the issue and, with the support of farmers, adopted its own rule phasing in the change. So go first to 144 inches, and by the beginning of this year, we have all major producers be cage-free, meaning free to walk around inside the barn. Well, there's a bit of an update, folks, on the lawmakers moving to roll back the cage-free hens rule. So, we need to stay tuned on that one. Here's the next story. Trump fumes as Zelensky says war's end is far away. Well, President Donald Trump slammed Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Monday for suggesting that the end of Russia's war against Ukraine is still very, very far away, said Zelensky. The comments come as prominent Trump allies escalate pressure on Zelensky to dramatically change his approach to the U.S. president, who has made quickly ending the war a top priority. Or Zelensky needs to step aside, they say. The long, complicated relationship between the leaders reached a low point, otherwise known as a nadir, N-A-D-I-R, a low point, following a disastrous White House meeting in which Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance excoriated Zelensky for not being sufficiently thankful for U.S. support for Ukraine since Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the February 22 invasion. This is the worst statement that could have been made by Zelensky, and America will not put up with it for much longer, Trump said in a post on his Truth Social platform about the comments Zelensky made late Sunday while speaking to reporters in London. Trump, at an event at the White House later on Monday, referred to Zelensky's reported comments and asserted the Ukrainian leader, quote, better not be right about that, unquote. If somebody doesn't want to make a deal, I think that person won't be around very long, Trump added. That person will not be listened to very long. Trump took issue with Zelensky suggesting it would take time to come to an agreement to end the war. The Ukrainian leader also tried to offer a positive take on the U.S.-Ukraine relationship in the aftermath of last week's White House meeting. Asked by a reporter about the outlines of a new European initiative to end Russia's war, Zelensky said, quote, we are talking about the first steps today, and therefore, until they are on paper, I would not like to talk about them in great detail, unquote. An agreement to end the war is still very, very far away, and no one has started all of these steps yet, Zelensky added. But Trump was only further irritated by Zelensky suggesting it would take time for the conflict to come to a close. It was what I was saying. This guy doesn't want there to be peace as long as he has America's backing and Europe, in the meeting they had with Zelensky, stated flatly that they cannot do the job without the U.S. Probably not a great statement to have been made in terms of a show of strength against Russia, Trump added in his post. What are they thinking, he said. Zelensky took to social media soon after Trump's latest criticism. He did not directly refer to Trump's comments, but underscored that it, quote, is very important that we try to make our diplomacy really substantive to end this war the soonest possible, unquote. And that, folks, is an update for you on the war between Zelensky and Trump, between Ukraine and Russia in this case. And let's go ahead to another story. The University of Arizona announces investment in key areas of research. University of Arizona President Suresh Garimella announced Monday a one-time investment of $20 million for research in space sciences, water and energy, biomedicine, healthcare, and mining. This will build on the recent transformational advances in technology and allow us to lead Arizona and our region into a position of global leadership for these key industries. The $20 million will come from the Arizona Board of Regents Technology and Research Initiative Fund. Garavella told the Star Monday that he also hopes to grow the UA's research enterprise from $1 billion to $2 billion, but gave no timetable. In the face of federal funding cuts under the Trump administration, Tomas Diaz de la Rubia, the University of Arizona's Senior Vice President for Research and Innovation, has encouraged UA's researchers to, quote, seek alternative funding sources from foundations and non-federal sponsors, unquote. The Star asked Garamella, President Garamella, that is, and Diaz de la Rubia, Monday about how solid alternative sources would be. Garamella responded that they don't know how, quote, unsolid, unquote, federal funding is. We don't know the extent of the hit, Garamella said. Look, we'd be lying if we said we knew we were going to go, where we were going to go, but we're hoping that it all ends up in a place that is not quite as dire as we'll keep, and we'll keep adjusting. All we can do is our best to plan. We feel optimistic, he said. So there you have it. That's an update on the University of Arizona announcing a key investment in a number of industries that should help the University of Arizona's reputation in research. So let's go to that last story. It's about the Pope, and he's suffered another setback, unfortunately. He's been put on ventilation. Pope Francis, it says here, suffered two new episodes of acute respiratory crises Monday, that's yesterday, and was put back on non-invasive mechanical ventilation, the Vatican said. Francis had another setback in what has become a more than two-week battle to overcome a complex respiratory infection and pneumonia. During the latest crisis, Francis remained alert, oriented, and cooperated with medical personnel. The prognosis remained, however, guarded. Earlier Monday, Pope Francis issued a new message from the hospital as Vatican officials begged him to let his voice be heard after disappearing from public view for over 2 weeks as he recovers. Francis, who is 88 years old, denounced the, quote, progressive irrelevance, unquote, of international organizations to combat war as he remained at Rome's Gemelli Hospital in stable condition. He was up, had breakfast, and was receiving therapies after sleeping well all night long, the Vatican said. The Vatican hasn't released any photos or videos of Francis since before he entered the hospital on February 14th with a complex lung infection. This has become the longest absence of his 12-year papacy. Well, let's hope for the best for Pope Francis. And that, folks, completes our front page stories. They were Tucson logs driest August to March on record, lawmakers move to roll back cage-free hens rule, Trump fumes as Zelensky says war's end is, quote, far away, unquote, the University of Arizona announces investment in key areas of research, and then finally the Pope suffers another setback and has been put on non-invasive ventilation. Let's go ahead and go to our local stories in the Star this morning. If you're just joining us, welcome. Welcome in. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. We're reading the Star for today, Tuesday, the 4th of March, 2025. And let's go ahead and look at the local news this morning. It has to do with more than $300,000 spent to sway voters on Proposition 414. Well, what's that about? More than $300,000 has been spent on efforts to influence voters on Proposition 414, the half-cent sales tax increase. Tucson voters will decide March 11th. Tucson voters will decide on the $800 million plan that raises the city's sales for nearly 10 years to mostly pay for items linked to police and fire expenses. The proposition would send about 66% of the expected $80 million per year the tax would raise to public safety needs. About 34%, or the remainder of that then, would go to address issues related to affordable housing, homelessness, and other social needs. If approved, Proposition 414 would raise the city sales tax rate by a half cent, from 8.7% to 9.2% for the next decade. Ballots for the all-male selection were sent February 12th. The deadline to mail your ballot back is Wednesday, according to the city. Nearly 306,000 mail-in ballots were sent to Tucson voters. The Tucson Metro Chamber Political Action Committee's opposition campaign spent nearly $180,000 through the first 2 months of the year, about $53,500 in January and about $126,000 in February, according to filings with the Arizona State, that's the Arizona Secretary of State's office. The largest expenditure, about $75,000, was spent on TV, radio, and online advertising in February. Tucson Metro Chamber's Political Action Committee raised nearly $120,000 as of February 17th. The Arizona Multi-Housing Association and Arizona Lodging and Tourism Association, both Phoenix-based organizations, each donated $40,000 to the Political Action Committee, and $25,000 was sent from the Tucson Association of Realtors, and so on. So this is the addition of $300,000 spent to sway voters on Proposition 414, which would be the sales tax increase from 8.7 to 9.2 cents for the next decade. Let's go ahead and move on to the next story in the Tucson and Region section of the Star. And it is about district's new book review process sparks concern. Well, that is about library books to students. An Arizona school district's new process for deciding literature choices for students might discourage the use of, quote, controversial, unquote, novels, say some librarians and parents who are concerned about that prospect. And a police investigation of one teacher after she assigned a novel, even though it was approved through that new process, heightens that concern for some. Higley Unified School District in Gilbert changed its process after the grandparents of a student complained about sensitive content in a list of novels from which students in one high school class could choose to read. Under Higley's new process, a committee made up of educators, parents, and community members reviews books, identifying sensitive topics in each novel while weighing them against the literary merit of the book. The public then has 60 days to review the books and provide feedback before the governing board decides whether to approve them for classroom use. The process to add a book to the approved list takes a full year. State law already required parental permission to student exposure to sexually explicit material at school. Now, Higley also requires a more thorough formal permission slip for novels with sexually explicit content, violence, drug, or alcohol use, sensitive content to race and ethnicity, offensive language, and contest related to mental health or suicide. That doesn't sound quite right. Let's see. Higley also requires a more thorough formal permission slip for novels with sexually explicit content, violence, drug, or alcohol use, and has to be sensitive to content on race and ethnicity. There we go. The new review process was modeled off similar existing processes in nearby school districts, including Scottsdale Unified and Paradise Valley Unified School Districts. It also mirrors a trend nationwide. There has been increasing regulation from state boards of education, state legislatures, and local school boards that resemble Higley Unified's new policy around books, said Deborah Caldwell Stone, who's the director of the American Library Association Office for Intellectual Freedom. These regulations, Caldwell Stone said, treat books as items that can cause harm. Caldwell Stone said she thought Higley Unified's process would stigmatize certain topics and likely dissuade teachers from recommending any literature that might touch on a theme that a parent might find controversial or sensitive. That could limit the availability of challenging, enriching literature for students, she said. So that's a little bit on the district's, the Higley district's new book review process, sparking some concern. And now let's go ahead and move into RFK Jr.'s ideas on health. He is controversial and divisive, but newly confirmed U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a loyal following in Arizona. Among his supporters is Arizona resident and entrepreneur Callie Means. That's M-E-A-N-S, Callie Means, who has been at the state capitol this session promoting two bills that target junk food. The bills, sponsored by Lake Havasu City Republican Representative Leo Biasiucci, that's Leo Biasiucci, recently got approval from the state House of Representatives and are now headed for the Senate. Excitement about Kennedy, known as RFK Jr., was palpable as a collection of Arizona Republicans, including Means, that's including Callie Means, comedian Rob Schneider, former race car driver Danica Patrick, and Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn gathered in Phoenix in early February to launch support for the Biasiucci bill that would prohibit certain food additives contained in products such as frosted strawberry Pop-Tarts and nacho cheese Doritos from being served or sold in public school. I want to thank RFK Jr., Biasiucci said during the event. It took Bobby to get in the position that he is now in for something like this to happen, and I can't thank him enough for being the microphone at the high level to finally put a spotlight on this. Attendees at the Phoenix event, who also included members of the conservative Turning Point Action Group, erupted into cheers and applause upon learning partway through the event that the Senate Finance Committee had advanced RFK Jr.'s nomination to become Health and Human Services Secretary. 9 days later, the full Senate confirmed him. When it was Means' turn to speak, he called Kennedy, quote, the most important cabinet secretary in modern American history, and praised him for questioning a food industry that gets kids addicted to ultra-processed food, unquote. Means is co-founder of a Tempe-based health and wellness technology company called TrueMed, and is also founder of the National End Chronic Disease Coalition, which has goals that align with Kennedy's Make America Healthy Again agenda, including ending incentives for ultra-processed food, removing toxic substances from food, and ending conflicts of interest in federal health agencies. So that's a little bit of the news on how RFK Jr.'s health ideas are influencing Arizonans. And I believe that's it. So our stories this morning in the local section were more than $300,000 has been spent to sway voters on Proposition 414. That's the sales tax increase proposition. District's new book review process sparks some concern. And then finally, how RFK Jr.'s health ideas are influencing Arizonans. Let's now go ahead, having covered the front page stories and the local stories, to the business section of the Star this morning. And in the business section, we have a couple of things to share with you today. The first one is $100 billion from chip giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, that's TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, could be a boon for Arizona. Chip giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company plans to invest a $100 billion in the United States, President Donald Trump announced Monday as he appeared with the company's head at the White House. TSMC, the world's biggest semiconductor manufacturer, produces chips for companies including Apple, Intel, and NVIDIA. The company had already announced plans to invest more than $65 billion in the U.S., including three plants in Arizona, after the Biden administration offered billions in subsidies. In its first Arizona factory, there has been a mass production of its 4-nanometer chips. Trump and TSMC's chief executive officer, CCY, that's Y as in W-E-I, CCY, said the $100 billion is on top of the $65 billion that was already announced. This is a tremendous move by the most powerful company in the world, Trump said. It's a matter of economic security. CCY said the investment will be for two more chip manufacturing plants in Arizona, along with a packaging operation. Former President Joe Biden in 2022 signed a sweeping $280 billion law, the CHIPS, C-H-I-P-S, the CHIPS and Science Act, to try to reinvigorate chip manufacturing in the U.S., especially after the COVID-19 pandemic. During the pandemic, chip factories, especially those overseas, making the majority of processors, shut down. It had a ripple effect that led to wider problems, such as automobile factory assembly lines shutting down and fueled inflation. Trump has criticized the law and taken a different approach, instead threatening to impose high tariffs on imported chips to bring chip manufacturing back to the U.S. Trump also has said companies like TSMC do not need federal tax incentives. Trump has hosted multiple business leaders at the White House since he took office in January to tout a series of investments that aim to demonstrate his leadership is a boon for the U.S. economy. So that's a little bit about the $100 billion chip investment from TSMC that could be a boon for Arizona. And then for those of us who drink coffee, and particularly for those of you who like Starbucks, here's a little bit of news. Starbucks is making cuts to its menu, with some of the coffee giant's less popular beverages set to take their final bow this week. In its announcement, Starbucks outlined plans to remove a selection of drinks, and that includes several blended Frappuccino beverages, the Royal English Breakfast Latte, and the white hot chocolate. And that starts today. These items aren't commonly purchased, can be complex to make, or are like other beverages on our menu, Starbucks wrote. The Seattle-based company added that simplifying its menu would allow it to focus on fewer, more popular items, executed with excellence, they say. Starbucks says these cuts will reduce wait times, improve consistency, and make way for innovation. The chain says it will continue to introduce a handful of new items and seasonal specials, such as its Cortado beverage introduced last month and a new iced cherry chai set to debut in the spring. The menu changes arrive amid wider restructuring at the Seattle-based company. Starbucks also said that it would lay off 1,100 corporate employees globally this week, with CEO Brian Nicole citing the need to operate more efficiently. Nicole joined the chain as CEO in August. So there you have a couple of pieces from the business section this morning. The first one was $100 billion from chip giant TSMC could be a boon for Arizona, and the other one for you coffee lovers out there. Starbucks is cutting some less popular drinks from its menu. Let's move ahead now to the opinion section of the Star with the reminder to our listeners that the opinions I'm about to read are those of the writers of the opinion pieces. So let's go ahead and have a look at this first one. University research boosts Arizona. And the writer of this piece is Fred Duval. He's a member of the Arizona Board of Regents. Here's what Dr. Duval has to say. For decades, Arizona universities have been at the cutting edge, he says, of research breakthroughs, from agriculture to water conservation, from reaching up into space to see our future, to reaching back into anthropology to understand our past. These advancements have led to better lives and economic growth for our state. Arizona now has the fastest growing bioscience sector in the country. We have increased funding from the National Institutes of Health, that's to say the NIH, by 39% in the last 5 years, the nation's largest. Our universities have filed thousands of patents, launched hundreds of startups, and brought transformative technologies to market. Here is a very small sampling. Specifically, the University of Arizona's billion-dollar research enterprise includes developing new ways to detect and diagnose neurological conditions, including Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, stroke, chronic pain, and depression, and treatments for cardiovascular disease, such as heart failure and hypertension. The university is a leader in groundbreaking discoveries about the solar system's origin, as well as cybersecurity and national defense applications. The soon-to-open Center for Advanced Molecular and Immunological Therapies on the Phoenix campus seeks to unravel complexities of the immunology of cancers and infectious diseases. The University of Arizona is leading a multi-university study to investigate the effectiveness of blood or plasma donations in reducing cancer-causing chemicals in firefighters. And in institutional, and the institution meets its land-grant mission with work on sustainable farming, protecting Arizona's water resources, and aiding tribal nations' economic development. ASU and NAU have equally impressive work. It's all very good and exciting stuff. The result? Duval writes, the economic impact of our universities equals that of Arizona's largest industries, driving real-world solutions, economic prosperity, and improving lives. To build on this success and emerge as the national leader in health solutions, we must leverage our strength, he says. All of the Arizona's public universities hold top-tier status as R1 level research institutions. The University of Arizona and ASU projected research activity surpassing $1 billion in fiscal 2024. When numbers are confirmed by the National Science Foundation in the fall, the institutions will join a select group of just 33 universities across the nation to have achieved this billion-dollar milestone. We have built the Phoenix Biomedical Core, our downtown 30-acre life sciences innovation district, which will soon host two medical schools, and Tucson has become a hub of startups with national successes like Sinfonia RX, thanks to Tech Launch Arizona. The building blocks are in place, Duval writes. Now we must establish a clear focus. Namely, we are public institutions and we have a duty to ensure that our research, innovation, and technology development efforts deliver meaningful impact for our state. That is a priority of the Arizona Board of Regents. We should consider new policies, such as tax incentives and innovative funding models, to attract venture capital, monitoring metrics like patent filings and research ROI, that's return on investment, will help us track progress, and we need better strategic coordination between public and private sectors. In 10 years, success should look like the following: doubling venture capital investment in Arizona's life sciences ecosystem, he says, doubling university-born startups per year, creating 10,000 new high-quality jobs in the life sciences sector, achieving top 5 national ranking for bioscience research and development. Our success should be something to celebrate, something worth state pride and worth support. There is currently much in the news about the value of university research and the public sector's role in sponsoring that research. It was academic research that helped cure childhood polio, develop heart transplants, and establish better nutrition and biological sustainability. It was university researchers at Silicon Valley that led to the tech revolution and the fastest wage and economic growth in our nation's history. We are now at the tipping point in bioscience. Note that at the exact same time, there is pressure on us to retreat. China announced an exciting new breakthrough in cancer. Great news for the world, but not great news for our competitive position. We need university research now more than ever. And that opinion piece entitled "University Research Boosts Arizona" was written by Fred Duval. Fred Duval is a member of the Arizona Board of Regents. Let's go to our next opinion piece this morning. It's about the danger to U.S. health science research does not stop at RFK Jr. Let's go for this. And it has as its author this person, James Allwine. James Allwine, that's A-L-W-I-N-E, James Allwine. He's a virologist, professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, a visiting professor at the University of Arizona, a fellow of the American Academy for Microbiology, and of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So he has a lot of credentials. Let's see what he has to say. The danger to U.S. health science research, he says, does not stop at RFK Jr. He writes, "Over the past 2 months, a deluge of articles by thousands of scientists and healthcare professionals outlined..." Oops, I have a slight break here in service. There we go. We're back. Anyway, let me start that sentence over again. Here it is. "Over the past 2 months, a deluge of articles by thousands of scientists and healthcare professionals outlined the dangers of installing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services," that's HHS as an abbreviation, "yet the Senate confirmed him. This means that the country will be subjected to myriad adverse outcomes arising from Kennedy's anti-vaccine positions, his conspiracy theories, and fringe beliefs. However, the threat to U.S. health sciences research does not stop with Kennedy. Two other nominations, Dr. J. Bhattacharya," that's J. Bhattacharya, "to head the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and Dr. Dave Weldon as director of the Centers of Disease Control, the CDC, are gravely concerning to the future of U.S. health science research and public health. The NIH supports the majority of life science and disease research in the U.S. through grant funding of research projects at universities, institutes, and companies at every state." That's in every state. "In 2024, $37.433 million was allotted for scientific research throughout the U.S., creating jobs and economic growth in every state. The director of NIH should be a respected scientist who will support researchers and shepherd the NIH research mission. But Bhattacharya, a physician and economist from Stanford University, has a deep disdain for scientists. During the pandemic, he referred to those working on the front lines as, quote, mad scientist virologists, hypochondriacal epidemiologists, and megalomaniacal science bureaucrats," unquote. These were people who, in record time, obtained critical knowledge of the virus, prepared effective vaccines and drugs and delivered them to the American people. But Acharya's disrespect for scientists disqualifies him as the director of NIH. But there is more. Bhattacharya is a purveyor of bad science and misinformation. He was an author of the Great Barrington Declaration, a widely criticized proposal from October 2020 before vaccines were available. The proposal showed a lack of understanding of pathogen biology, advising that COVID-19 mitigation strategies should be removed in favor of the mass infection of Americans that would purportedly usher in herd immunity. It would be virtually impossible for such a, quote, let it rip, unquote, approach to ever contain SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, because the virus changes so rapidly. And if this strategy had been followed, there would have been many additional COVID-19 deaths. After the vaccine became available, Bhattacharya spread misleading information about COVID-19 boosters, claiming that the bivalent booster had not been tested in humans. This is incorrect and undermines the system of approval of vaccines that has been successfully and safely applied to vaccines used in the U.S. Given his disdain for scientists, his lack of knowledge of pathogen biology, and his willful dissemination of misinformation about vaccines, J. Bhattacharya would be a disastrously inappropriate director of NIH. He would severely damage and debilitate the most preeminent disease and public health research infrastructures in the world. Another dangerous nominee is Dr. Dave Weldon to head the CDC. The CDC conducts disease research, develops health policy, provides the public with critical science-driven information about disease outbreaks, food contamination, and public health problems. Yet the CDC increases the health security of our nation through science. Dr. Weldon, a physician, served in the Florida House of Representatives. In contrast to the mission of the CDC, he has actively spread misinformation about vaccines, including appearing in an anti-vaccine documentary in 2019. This film was found to be so wildly inaccurate and harmful to the public that it was pulled from several platforms, including YouTube and Amazon. Dr. Weldon promotes the disproven claim that the measles, mumps, and rubella, that's MMR, vaccine causes autism. He has cast doubt on the safety of the human papillomavirus, that is, vaccines, which have been shown both to be safe and to reduce the risk of cervical cancer by 90%. That's the HPV vaccine specifically. It is difficult to imagine the science and fact-driven mission of the CDC surviving under an individual who holds entrenched anti-science beliefs. Make no mistake, writes Professor Allwine. The Trump administration has declared war on the health sciences by nominating Bhattacharya and Weldon. They will damage U.S. disease and vaccine research in irreparable ways. If you care about health, especially that of young children, write to your senators and demand that these anti-science, anti-vaccine nominees not be confirmed. So that piece was entitled, The Danger to U.S. Health Science Research Does Not Stop at RFK Jr. And that opinion piece was written this morning by James Allwine. He's a virologist, a professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, a visiting professor at the University of Arizona, a fellow of the American Academy for Microbiology, and also a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So that's the opinion piece there. And then finally, we have an opinion piece entitled, Our Hearts Are Missing for These Children. And this piece is written by Shraddha Hilda Oropeza. That's O-R-O-P-E-Z-A, Oropeza. She is a spiritual healer, a wellness coach, and a yoga teacher, and she lives in Tucson. And the title of her opinion piece this morning is, Our Hearts Are Missing for These Children. Some Republicans in state government, she writes, were angry to the point of outrage over the state's Child Protective Services agency more than a decade ago. They said parental rights were being trampled by an agency that seemed too quick to take children from their homes. The then governor, Jan Brewer, called for reform, and in 2014 signed a bill creating the Department of Child Safety to replace Child Protective Services. One key provision of the law was a ban on the agency taking children from their parents and placing them in foster care without a court order. Brewer and others hailed it as a victory for parents and children. 4 years later, the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform said in its newsletter, in review of Arizona's efforts, quote, "For the overwhelming majority of children, family preservation is the safer option. It is foster care that is riskier in every respect," unquote. This recent political history came to mind as I finished reading Celeste Ng's book, Our Missing Hearts. Her work of fiction weaves a realistic story of a child of color trying to avoid government officials in an authoritarian, racist society as he searches for his long-gone mother. In an author's note at the end of the story, detailing what inspired her, Ng wrote, "There is a long history in the U.S. and elsewhere of removing children as a means of political control." By the way, the spelling on the author of this book, I'm saying Ng, the spelling is N-G, capital N-G, Ng. Indeed, continues Oropeza in this opinion piece, black children taken from enslaved parents, indigenous children kidnapped from their villages and relocated to government and religious boarding schools, and of course, brown children separated from their parents at the border not far from where I live. That last one continues, so it is current news rather than history. Where were the court orders or moral authority for all those takings? Where is the effort to reunite unoccupied children with their parents rather than keep them in foster care or in cages or otherwise warehousing them? More important, where is the protest from parental rights advocates? Where is the outrage from pro-life and pro-family advocates? It is tucked away in their suburban homes or in the halls of the posh public paid for private schools to which they send their own children? Is their anger and outrage being held in reserve for the next brown child they see, suspecting she is in the country unaccompanied or without documentation, or just that she is brown? A couple of cold, hard statistics to perhaps elicit a little outrage. Specifically, more than half of Arizona foster children are brown or black, according to court-appointed special advocates for children. Any outrage from white-dominant society? The number of Arizona children who died from abuse and neglect has nearly doubled from what it was in 2014 when reform went into place, according to Arizona's Family. That's Arizona's Family, capital A, capital F, self-proclaimed as the state's largest television news organization. Yet there is no outrage about reforms to the child welfare system. Where is the outrage? Where are our missing hearts? That opinion piece this morning by Shraddha Hilda Oropeza. She's a spiritual leader, wellness coach, and yoga teacher. She lives in Tucson. So our opinion pieces this morning were that one and a couple of others, and their titles were as follows. Oh, nope, I guess I lost those titles. My apologies. So I'm going to go ahead and move on to the giving section. And that's going to end our broadcast this morning, I think, on the light note of Tucson giving. And it's a wonderful testament to the giving nature of Tucson. Fast pitch event to help local nonprofits. And it's the 10th anniversary of Social Venture Partners, Tucson Fast Pitch, a community-building event, has evolved into the epitome of philanthropic storytelling in the old Pueblo. We have dedicated Fast Pitch, otherwise known as FP, to helping nonprofit organizations tell their stories to garner support and spread awareness, and we are celebrating our story and the impact we have had over the last 10 years. We have served more than 100 nonprofits and directed more than $1.8 million directly as a result of the FP program. And the magnetism continues to have a ripple effect on the individuals and organizations that uplift our community, said Brittany Battle, Fast Pitch Director and Master of Ceremonies for the upcoming event. Fast Pitch, named for its showcase of three-minute presentations by 8 local nonprofits, begins at 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 3rd, at the Fox Tucson Theater, 17 West Congress. So that's Fast Pitch. While on stage at the event, can net $125,000 plus for participating nonprofits, Basil said that the public awareness is priceless. We have found that those who attend the event are truth seekers who care deeply about our community. They want to understand the critical issues faced by nonprofits on the front lines and to help solve those issues. They want to be deeply empowered and have their giving spirits activated. The event was designed to build the capacity of nonprofits and ultimately boost the entire community, according to Ann Miske, who's the president and CEO of SVP Arizona. Fast Pitch highlights the tremendous work these nonprofits do for the Tucson area. So, if you go, it's 7 p.m., Thursday, April 3rd, at the Fox Theater, Fox Tucson Theater, 17 West Congress. Well, I think that about does it for me. We're going to have to leave it there. And I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I've been bringing you the Arizona Daily Star for today, Tuesday, the 4th of March, 2025. And I'd like to thank you so much for the privilege of your time. And I'm wishing you the best of goodbyes.